Technology has given us the ability to look deep into the human body and to see how the body reacts to various environmental stimuli. That being the case, we simply must ask, is the body of one who habitually drinks alcohol happy or sad?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1374th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Portofino who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, in 2004, archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania made a discovery worthy of a celebratory toast. Their chemical analysis of pottery fragments from a prehistoric village in northern China indicated that people who lived in the village 8,000 to 9,000 years ago were making wine from rice, honey, and fruit. Folks must have enjoyed what they were making because today they are still making and drinking alcohol. And for the past few decades at least, they've been told by scientific studies that it's okay to drink alcohol in moderation. In fact, drinking in moderation can help you live longer and have a lower risk of heart disease than those who abstain. But we wonder, is the body of one who habitually drinks alcohol a happy body or a sad body? Well, who better to ask than Timothy B. Sullivan, who is the PhD and a doctor of psychiatry and internal medicine at Northwell Health on Staten Island. Dr. Timothy, welcome to the Food Chain.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yes. So, a doctor of psychiatry and internal medicine. That means you're a doctor of mind and body, both.
That's true, and increasingly that's important in psychiatry as well as in medicine, that we recognize the crucial links between our mental health and our physical health. They intersect, they influence one another, and you know, it's appropriately a concern of all physicians.
Well, good, and I'm so happy to have this opportunity to talk with a doctor of mind and body, because there's so much that I wondered about, the connection between the two. How did the two come together in your career as a physician? Because usually you're a doctor of body or a doctor of mind, but I don't think I've ever met a doctor of mind and body.
There are a few of us around. There's a small group of those of us who've studied both traditional internal medicine and psychiatry. I was interested in psychiatry as a student in my teenage years. My parents were both psychiatric social workers, and that exposed me to the field. And I went to medical school thinking I'd be a psychiatrist, but my medical school at the time at Dartmouth had a program to try to turn us all into primary care docs, because then, as now, there are too few physicians working in primary care, and we all know the problems that creates with regard to access to good quality care. So that led me into internal medicine. But, you know, as I got into the practice of it, I kept finding myself going up to the library and reading articles about psychiatry and thinking that I might really be better fit for that profession. So I went back and did a residency in psychiatry, and here I am.
For those of us who do not know, what is the difference between psychiatry and psychology?
So there's a lot of overlap. Psychiatrists are medical physicians, so they go to medical school, graduate with an MD degree. After medical school, they have to do a residency in psychiatry, which is usually 4 years, unless they want to specialize in child and adolescent psychiatry, in which case it's a 5-year plan. And also they can do fellowships after the 4 years of basic training in subspecialties like, for instance, addiction psychiatry, relevant to our topic today. Psychologists go to graduate school. So, you know, it's a more academic plan of study. And from there, it branches out a lot because it depends on what aspect of psychology they want to pursue. They can become experimental psychologists and really work within research institutes, and they have a particular career path for that. They can become academics who teach at universities, or they can become clinicians. And there are a large number. There are many more psychologists in the U.S. than there are psychiatrists. And they provide a lot of crucial psychotherapeutic help. They also, some of them can do valuable things like psychological testing, which we know from students in school, particularly people with attention deficit problems, is often really helpful in identifying their needs. So those psychologists who pursue clinical degrees get some classroom training, if you will, in graduate school, and then they do internships and externships to get clinical experience under supervision before they actually go out to private practice. I will say, as tough as med school is, we didn't have to do a thesis defense, which psychologists do, and I don't envy them for that that requirement, because those are tough.
I had to do a thesis presentation when I was getting my lower division degree in English and Chinese literature, and you know, I had to defend both to wow. each other, which was interesting. Sounds like what you were dealing with there. But to the big question from me to you as a doctor of mind and body, in general terms, Dr. Sullivan, how does the mind and the body and get along with the body and the body get along with the mind? What is the, how do they work together?
Well, it's in fact really complex when we talk about it from the perspective of physiology, like how our cells work within the body. What are the forms of communication between the various components of our self? In a very general way, you can say that we all know that if we're not in a good place emotionally, our body suffers along with our mood, and vice versa. That if our body isn't well, it affects our sense of energy, our sense of well-being. Those are, you know, from a common sense perspective, something that we all appreciate. Physiologically, the relationships are very complex, which we now understand. For example, we know that our mood is influenced even by the activity of our immune system, and depending on how active or inactive our immune system is, the immune system can produce substances which can then in turn affect everything from our ability to concentrate to how energetic we feel. One common example of this is substances called cytokines, which are produced when our immune system stirred up, like when we have a cold. And they're responsible for our feeling fatigued, often some of the other associated symptoms of muscle discomfort and so on. But the cognitive symptoms that we feel that are consequent to activation of the immune system can be significant. I had a patient years ago who had had a history of depression, who developed a severe lung infection and was put on an antibiotic. And he called me up and said, "I think I'm getting depressed again." And in that instance, we talked through it. His life was in pretty good shape at that moment. He was still taking his antidepressant that was protecting him from a recurrence. So I talked to his internist, and we stopped the antibiotic in that instance because it wasn't absolutely necessary, and his mood improved. And in retrospect, we think that it was because the medication was producing side effects that mimicked how it felt when he was depressed, and that alone was enough to begin to get him ruminating and propelling his mood in a depressive direction. So it can be sometimes subtle, and sometimes, there are conditions, various cancers and other kinds of inflammatory illnesses which we know are associated with a high risk of depression, for example. Diseases of the endocrine system that can produce symptoms like manic depressive illness. So,
wow.
Much we could say.
There's a lot of connections there. I once did a show with Dr. Timothy Schoenthaler, who is a professor of psychology, I believe, at one of the California universities. And he did a study in a prison, feeding half of his subjects a plain old multivitamin and the other half a sugar pill. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that those who were fed the multivitamin reduced their felonious behavior in prison by 47%. So nutrition must be part of the equation as well.
It is, and it's still an area that we don't know quite enough about. I mean, the whole issue about vitamin supplements is complex and argued. Generally, most experts who do research in this area feel it's more important for us to eat a nutritious, balanced diet than to rely on supplements. The other interesting thing about supplements is, and this gets to something that's often called the placebo effect, which is another relationship between mind and body. You know, placebo effects have a bad name because we think of it as being sort of a trick that's played on the mind or the body. But in fact, what placebos represent, and even, minor interventions like a multivitamin, which is really not a medicine conventionally. Right? Those things represent an act of caring. Someone is caring for us. They're giving us something to help us feel better, to feel differently. And it turns out that that is really important to our well-being. It can help us in our recovery. And simply thinking that we're doing something actively to promote our own wellness, that as well is powerful and has been shown to be really helpful even in the recovery or adaptation to severe illness.
That sure says a lot about the power of the mind itself, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
Okay. Well, we've been making and drinking wine for 9,000 years that we know of and drinking it and getting into a lot of trouble doing it, but we keep doing it. So there must be something good about it. What is good about it?
Well, I think if we look at the history of spirits, spiritus fermenti, obviously they make us feel good. Right? They produce a sense of well-being, however illusory, and often, particularly in a social context, will help smooth conversation. Most of the time, people are in a better mood.
We're going to have to take a quick break, but I want to pick that up and carry it forward in our conversation about alcohol, alcohol abuse, substance abuse, and what on earth we can do to better manage our love for alcohol. And we do seem to have that love. We're with Dr. Timothy B. Sullivan from the Northwell Health, and he's a doctor of mind and a doctor of medicine, so we get to talk with both sides of our body. So please do stay tuned. We will be right back after these important messages.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back, and we're talking about alcohol, and of course, it's such a big part of the human history. Alcohol, and contemporary history in our lives, day-to-day lives, too. And a lot of us do drink. A few of us don't drink. A lot of us drink a little bit. Some of us drink too much. So we're trying to come to grips with what all of this means, the alcohol, and its impact on both our mind and our body. Now, why can we do that? Well, because we have Dr. Timothy B. Sullivan with us today. And he is a doctor of psychiatry and internal medicine at Northwell Health on Staten Island in the Big Apple. And so that 9,000 years, and we were talking about the good things that are related with alcohol, because surely we've been drinking it for 9,000 years. If there's something really bad, we would put it aside, but we haven't. Are we able to put it aside, Doctor?
Well, individuals can find it difficult, depending on their makeup, and we could say something about what predisposes people to difficulty with alcohol abuse or alcohol dependence.
Well, maybe we can pick that up down the line a little bit, I guess.
Sure. In terms of our history with alcohol, we know the ancients thought of it as a gift from the gods because of how it made us feel. Unfortunately, it is simply a natural substance that's produced in some circumstances, and it turns out not because of any divine design, but because of serendipity, that alcohol interacts with our brains in ways that we find pleasurable and that encourage us to have more. It stimulates our pleasure centers and rewards us to a point with both the physical sense of well-being as well as the mental elation that we can experience when we drink. That doesn't mean it's really good for us. I think, when we ask ourselves as a society, what's our future with alcohol, we're well aware, most of us, that alcohol can be a serious health risk, and that requires all of us to be thoughtful about our own behavior as well as of those, the behavior of those that we love. There is an interesting question, which I'm sure we'll get to because of some recent research about, is it ever good for us, even though it makes us feel good?
And that's exactly where we want to go right now. So for decades, it seems, I have seen scientific studies come floating by that suggest that alcohol really is good for us. And if we just drink it in moderation, we'll be much better off than those people who don't drink it at all. And that includes such things as heart disease and blah, 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 blah. And I always wondered about them, because something this good, has to be watched over pretty carefully in my book. So, these studies have come out and they do suggest that alcohol is relatively good for us and might even have healthful benefits for us. But scientists at the Canadian Institute for Substance Research relooked at 100 cohort studies of 5 million participants. First thing that caught my attention was cohort. What does that mean?
So that's a statistical term, which means the researchers have identified a group based on certain characteristics. So a cohort could be a group that has been exposed to a certain health risk at a certain point in their life. So it's a way of defining who it is you're going to study and what is it about them that is going to separate them, say, from a different group that might be used for comparison.
Okay. For example, you could start with men and women. Or mm-hmm. old or young or so on, and divided up like that. 5 million people, that would suggest that there's some big computers working on some numbers here to keep track of things.
Definitely.
Okay. Yeah. So they looked at these studies, and they suggest that it's not true that alcohol in moderation is beneficial. So maybe you can help us unpack these studies and let us know how the researchers came to that conclusion, because it's a pretty big deal when it gets right down to it. The bottom line of the study that light and moderate drinkers are systematically healthier than current abstainers on a range of health indicators unlikely to be associated with alcohol use. So my first thought was that, well, it sounds like this study was brought to you by the Seagram's company or the wine industry or the beer folks. because it says good things about drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. What does Dr. Timothy Sullivan say?
Well, you know, researchers have been skeptical about these claims for a long time. They go back to the 1970s. There were some studies, particularly looking at populations in France where there's pretty regular wine consumption, and finding associations between mild to moderate use, particularly of wine, and you know, apparent health benefits, and as you say, particularly cardiovascular health. The researchers were skeptical because when we look at what alcohol does in the body, it's not a pretty picture. Alcohol is a toxin. It affects structures in our cells, particularly very important structures called mitochondria, which are involved in energy regulation. And, you know, a lot of people, for instance, who are concerned about their health will eat foods that are high in things like antioxidants, right? So antioxidants help to get rid of substances that are in our cells, like our mitochondria, that are floating around, these oxidated molecules, which can act like little electrical charges and damage proteins that are crucial to our cells' functioning. So it turns out alcohol does that too. It produces those same oxidants that oftentimes when we're trying to be healthy, we're trying to get rid of.
So they're kind of like miniature bumper cars.
Bumper cars with a zap, though. Bumper cars that can do some damage. Right?
Okay.
So we know that about alcohol, and we obviously know that in large amounts, alcohol can be quite damaging to the brain and heart and other organs, liver, et cetera.
What does it do to the brain?
It damages cells, and particularly cells that might be in an active state of metabolism. So it turns out, for the most part, our brains don't grow too many new nerve cells once we get past childhood. Right? In fact, there's at various stages in our lives, our brains prune away, sort of like pruning a bush that's grown to be too big, prune away nerve connections and make them more efficient. And it's amazing what we can do. As babies, we have, you know, many, many thousands times more nerve cells than we do as adults. But it still works okay, right? It turns out that there are cells that are newly generated in certain areas of the brain, particularly that are involved in memory. And those cells are quite sensitive to the effects of alcohol, in the same way that cancer cells that are dividing are sensitive to chemotherapy, because in the process of dividing, cells are more vulnerable. So these cells are, some of them are particularly in a structure called the hippocampus, which is a crucial center for memory formation. Alcohol is quite toxic to that region of the brain, which is why one of the hallmarks of severe alcoholism can be loss of memory. That generally doesn't affect people unless they're really drinking to excess. However, in lower amounts, alcohol can still damage some of those cells, as well as some of the other structures, because of its, as I mentioned earlier, its toxic effects on cell metabolism.
If such is happening in the brain, what is happening to the thought processes of our mind?
So oftentimes, effects like this, which particularly those that accrue gradually over years, are not easily observed, not until they reach a kind of tipping point. And part of that's because the brain is pretty adaptable. You know, it can find its way around a lot of obstacles. We can recruit functions from parts of the brain be able to make up for relatively modest impairments in cognition. But there's a point at which, for each of us, our brains are unable to continue to adapt. And, you know, the first signs of that typically would be problems with learning or memory. There are other nervous system effects, but again, those are usually associated with more severe alcohol use and can include problems with coordination and walking and so on. But the other thing is that as our brains have trouble with learning and thinking, that has secondary effects on things like our mood regulation. So we know that alcohol, even in relatively modest amounts, increases the risk of depressed mood and anxiety. And some people are going to be more sensitive to that than others because of their makeup, because of how their brains are structured and because of the complex systems that are involved in regulating our mood. It's also because as we struggle with our cognition, one of the areas that's most sensitive is our social communication. And if that begins to be affected and affected also by problems with mood regulation, that can create personality change, some of which we can see even acutely when people drink too much, right? They some people are angry drunks, as they say, right? And that's a kind of acute effect of the kind of thing we're talking about can accumulate over time.
Good. Well, let's turn our attention back to the studies. And the the folks in Canada did a re-look at a meta-analysis of 107 studies of 5 million people, used their computers to re-look at these things. And they came up with the fact that there's biases in the studies. And particularly, there's the bias of looking at people in poor health and judging other people by their poor health and age as well. So how did you see these biases impacting the studies?
So I thought it was, you know, it's difficult when we read a study to take into account all of the variables that the researchers may have been aware of and trying to control for. But this issue is particularly a problem when we look at population health studies, right? When we're trying to look at a large number of people, which is often necessary to detect other than huge effects on health. You know, I mean, if we were studying something like, well, like with some of the studies about the pandemic, for instance, that affected lots of people, and we wasn't that hard to see evidence of changes, say, in rates of depression and even suicide as a consequence of something like the pandemic. But when you're looking at lifestyle habits, how much someone drinks or what kind of diet they follow, there are a couple key issues here. And these come up in the studies that the researchers cite. One of them is many of these things depend on self-report, right? You ask someone, how much do you drink? What do you eat? So forth.
Very little.
Yes. And that's the usual answer you get when you ask someone how much they're drinking. But the other part of that is that it's not possible for researchers to kind of have a little camera watching you and checking to see what you eat. We depend on people's self-report, and that so the accuracy of that is one variable that's really hard to control for. The other is when we try to select the cohorts, as we mentioned earlier, the populations we want to study, we may inadvertently, when we're doing research, select groups of people who have characteristics that predispose them to better health, and it's not apparent at the time that you're trying to identify the group you want to study. So, and some of this also becomes an issue in terms of who's going to participate. If you're doing studies like the database type studies that you mentioned earlier, that are where computers are crunching numbers, well, that's okay, because there isn't a bias there. They're looking at a whole population, unless you say, well, it's a population with health insurance. Okay, well, that's a bias, because what about the people without health insurance or with different health insurance? All of those things may affect the outcomes. But when you're talking about trying to get a handle on health habits, it's hard to avoid not having to deal with the way in which the groups are chosen.
Well, good. Well, the study did, the study of the studies did come up with some really incredible conclusions that I'm sure nobody wants to hear, but they're going to hear it when they get back from this break. We are talking alcohol with Dr. Timothy B. Sullivan. He is a doctor of psychiatry and internal medicine, doctor of mind and body at Northwell Health, and we will be right back after these messages. And we're going to learn what the studies of 5 million people really told us. And what it really told us is kind of frightening for those of us who like to have a sip of wine. Do stay tuned. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, they took a look at 5 million people who drank alcohol to one extent or another, and they came upon some conclusions that were contrary to the kinds of conclusions that we've been hearing for a few decades that say drinking alcohol in moderation can be good for you. And the studies of so many people, the bottom line of their findings is simple. Previous studies that said moderate drinking was healthy for you was not valid. Not, doctor?
Yeah, it was, alarming and important enough that the World Health Organization went on to issue an advisory based on these studies. And there are really two messages within them. One is that, in asking the question about whether alcohol in low to moderate amounts is good for you, researchers in the past tended to focus on cardiovascular health. And some of that had to do with the nature of the health concerns that were preoccupying researchers at the time those studies were done. We'll get back to the cardiovascular health question in a moment, but what these new studies really focus on more broadly is, well, what about our concern about other causes of mortality or morbidity? The crucial bit of information these recent studies have uncovered is that, whatever we might say about the relative risk of cardiovascular disease associated with alcohol in modest amounts, it turns out that alcohol use of any measure, any kind of alcohol use, increases our risk of cancer. That's a health risk that people have to think about, but typically don't. Most of the discussion about health and alcohol has focused around this issue of cardiovascular health. And there are questions there about, as we were saying earlier, about, did they really control for all the right variables? Were the self-reports accurate and so on? Can we really rely on those results to say that it's good for our hearts? Maybe, maybe not. I think we have to say that's still an issue to be resolved, but it's important that people realize that's not the only thing that determines whether you're going to lead a long and healthy life. And cancer is increasingly a significant health risk, certainly in the United States, but also around the world. And as people are generally living longer because of some of the advances in health, cancer is becoming a bigger and bigger cause, and particularly as we think about the generations that are going to be entering into their 80s and 90s coming up, soon, particularly in Western countries, but also around the world, cancer is a significant concern. And that's the message, where no amount of alcohol is safe in that regard.
So going back to the studies, increased risk of all-cause mortality for those who consumed 0.9 ounce of alcohol per day. That's less than an ounce. That's less than a drink. So it's there. if you drink less than 0.9 of a 9% of a drink, then your risk of all-cause mortality is increased. Significantly increased for people who drink 1.6 ounces per day, okay, a drink and a half. And women, there was a significantly increased risk of all-cause mortality among female drinkers who drank 1 ounce of alcohol per day and among male drinkers who drank 2 ounces per day. So there it is. And the World Cancer Research Fund International suggests that consuming alcohol increases the risk of certain types of cancer, including that of the mouth, pharynx, larynx, esophageal, breast, colorectal, and so on and so on. And furthermore, all types of alcohol beverages, including wine, increase cancer risk. So this is not good for those of us who have an occasional drink. Less than one drink a day.
Yep. It's not cheery news, no, but, you know, we'll try to put it in some context. You know, all-cause mortality is taking all of those risks we face together and recognizing that, you know, because alcohol is a toxin, it does increase our risk of death. By what means is going to depend in part on our makeup.
Whatever is opportune, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and whatever our particular genetic makeup is and what risks we're especially vulnerable to. So that's the important message. But the other part of this is we're all exposed and sometimes intentionally expose ourselves to health risks all the time. Technically, getting into a car is exposing ourselves to a health risk because we know there's a certain rate of injury and mortality that's associated with driving a car or getting on an airplane, et cetera. Not to mention the people who do things like jump out of airplanes because it feels like fun. What's really crucial is that people think about the risk, that they understand these risks so that they're able to make a judgment for themselves. I think the hope is also by promoting understanding of these risks more thoroughly, that we move away from this kind of notion that, yeah, a little bit of alcohol is really good for us, as opposed to, okay, I'm choosing to drink because I enjoy it, but I know there are risks associated with it. I'm comfortable with those risks myself. It's a choice I'm making, but I'm going to think about it and maybe think about it depending on how that affects my approach to other risks I'm taking in life as well. And how it may affect people who are dependent on me and rely on me, whether it's my family or others.
Amen. As a doctor of mind and doctor of body, I'm wondering about alcoholism and where the line is crossed between being a moderate consumer of alcohol and somebody who's becomes dependent on alcohol for their day-to-day living. Where does one cross the line?
So, you know, in the field these days, they're actually less focused on terms like alcohol abuse or dependence, which are a little stigmatizing as well and sometimes not accurate. And the term of preference these days is alcohol use disorder, which I think focus alcohol use disorder. So, you know, focusing our attention on the fact that someone's using alcohol, but it's producing effects which are undesirable. And those could be, for instance, it could be health effects. So someone drinks to a point that is affecting their health in a way. You know, that could be somebody who doesn't drink that much, but they, say, have a significant medical condition where even a little bit of alcohol might be affecting the medications they take, might be affecting the organs that are also influenced by their illness process, in which case using any amount of alcohol mm-hmm. is creating risk for them. That's a problem, right?
Right.
Dependence is a specific problem where there are physical signs that someone is drinking so much alcohol that when they don't drink, they go through withdrawal. And that is a very severe state of ill health. And alcohol withdrawal can be life-threatening. The most severe form of alcohol withdrawal, delirium tremens, is associated with the risk of seizures, as well as even cardiovascular collapse. Thankfully, that's not very common because most people don't get close to drinking enough to produce that. But alcohol dependence in that physiological sense is a very serious health problem.
Do you, as a doctor of mind and body, is that dependence then physical or mental or both?
It's both. We're particularly concerned about the physical effects. You know, the effects of alcohol on the brain in that instance are what produce risk of seizures as well as the other kinds of withdrawal symptoms that you can see in alcohol dependence. The earliest signs of them are tremors. Eventually, people become sweaty. Their blood pressure changes. Their pulse may race. They become agitated. And pretty abruptly, very quickly sometimes, they can have a seizure, which can itself be very dangerous depending on where they are. So those manifestations are clearly because of the physiological effects of alcohol on the brain. But there is, along with that, a physical basis of a psychological craving for alcohol, which complicates the picture. It's very hard for people who are dependent on alcohol to stop because of how powerful that craving is. And because of how readily available alcohol is socially. You know, in the pandemic, there were a couple types of stores that stayed open, and one of the types of stores that stayed open were liquor stores, right? So that tells us about how important alcohol is.
Yeah, they closed down the gardening stores and kept open the liquor stores.
Closed the gyms, et cetera, but liquor stores, no. Right.
Yeah. Well, as someone who's made it your life's career to study the mind and body, in particular with respect to alcohol, how do you see a way out of the dependency on alcohol? Is there a way out that makes sense?
There are various paths out. I think, you know, obviously for someone who's developed alcohol dependence, the evidence, you know, where they're at risk for withdrawal and so forth, the evidence tells us that they're safest if they abstain from alcohol altogether. And to accomplish that, people with a history of alcohol dependence, there are medications that can help them, some to reduce the cravings, various approaches that will help them to maintain sobriety. And there are support organizations like Alcoholics Anonymous, obviously, which have been around for many, many years and helped many people to recovery. Increasingly, though, we're recognizing that not everybody can be abstinent, and this is particularly true of people who may not be physically dependent on alcohol, but still drink in ways that affect either their health or their behavior. So they may be angry at home or not showing up to work or working consistently. That's another kind of alcohol use disorder where they may not have as many physical effects, but many psychological effects. In many people, abstinence may not be achievable, even though it was obviously the safest outcome. So there's a field of what's called harm reduction strategies, where they try to encourage people to drink less and enough less that it doesn't produce the harmful effects that we're concerned about. Again, whether those are physical or psychological. And inevitably, it requires, you know, sometimes what's called medication-assisted treatment, MAT, of which there are several types that can assist in maintaining avoidance of alcohol.
Kind of like Nicorette or something like that?
It's like Nicorette for cigarettes, yeah. Oh. There's medications like naltrexone and others which are able to help people with these cravings. And increasingly, they're studying other methods of addressing the physical dimension of that craving for alcohol. Psychological support is really important. And some form of group support has been shown to be helpful. AA is one. There are others as well. We're social animals, you know, and we depend on groups, you know, whether it's our families, our communities, to help us know what direction to take in life, to get reinforcement for choices that we make. Group strategies really take advantage of that predisposition we have to want to find people with whom we can share goals and who can support us in trying to achieve them.
Well, as a doctor of mind and body, I have to ask you, are the minds and bodies of those who habitually drink alcohol happy minds and bodies or sad minds and bodies?
If people drink enough to affect either their physical, emotional, or their social health, that where there are discernible effects on those areas of their life, then it's not a happy body or a happy mind.
It's a sad one, then.
It's a sad one, yes.
And you see people turn that around?
Absolutely. Recovery is not only possible, it is frequent. There are many more. I think one thing that's positive in recent decades is there's many more people who have a public platform of one sort or another, whether it's celebrities or others.
And they stand up and say, I did it. And there you
right,
go.
Right, right. Former President of the United States, George W. Bush, yep. Right?
There you go. Well, Dr. Timothy B. Sullivan, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us and bringing some light into what has kind of been a very confusing subject, which is our use and abuse of alcohol. Thank you all for tuning in as well.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson.
All right.
And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.